Hi, my name is David Lopez, co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Newark, New Jersey, and this is The Power of Attorney. Today, it is my honor to have with us Juan Cartagena. Juan Cartagena is a nationally known civil rights leader. He is the president and general counsel of Latino Justice Pearl Def, Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund in New York City. And he is now a visiting professor, the Peter Rodino Distinguished Visiting Professor at Rutgers Law School, where he is teaching a course on Latinos in the law and also organizing several other activities with our students in the greater Rutgers Law community. Juan, welcome to Power of Attorney. How are you today?
Really doing well. Thank you, David, for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. And how's the semester going so far?
The semester is going really, really, really well. Love talking to the students. I got to not only the students in my class, but of course, you know, got to talk to other students with MSP and many other students along the way. So it was really wonderful to be here.
And you and I have known each other for a long time. So when we connected, I think probably about this time last year, maybe a little bit later, I was really, really excited that we were able to kind of explore the opportunity of bringing you to Rutgers. I know that you previously taught at Rutgers University, correct?
Yes, I've been teaching a constitutional course, a civil rights course to undergrad students going on, almost 30 years.
Oh, that's fantastic.
In New Brunswick, the Department of Latino Caribbean Studies.
That's absolutely fantastic. And I'm teaching an undergrad civil rights and civil liberties course this year also. So we should compare our syllabi. Yeah, so that's fantastic. And you're born and bred in Jersey City. So you're very familiar with Rutgers Law in Newark. And I know that you were very enthusiastic about the opportunity to come to the law school. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So Rutgers' reputation in progressive legal circles is amazing. It's got a wonderful place to learn and a wonderful place to teach and to work. I got to meet some of the big icons. Of course, I met Arthur Conoy, where we both sat on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And he is just an amazing icon of progressive lawyering. Only met Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg once at a ceremony for swearing in of Latino attorneys from New Jersey. And that was a joy to meet her. But others like Frank Askin, I've known, shared notes and litigation strategies with him. Ron Chen, litigation strategies for years with Ron Chen. And Charles Afonso, I've known for many, many years. Excellent leader in our community and of course, a great treasure for university as well. And David, you and I go way back, I think, to the days of our close friend, Jackie Berrien.
Yes.
The EEOC. So that's how far back we go.
Well, I'm sure you don't remember, but I was there at a big reception for you when you were first named as president of Latino Justice. There were many in the civil rights community, including Jackie and others there, to welcome you. And that's been, how long has that been? Like 12 years, 15 years?
No, 10. It'll be 10 in April. Next month, I'll be 10 years in.
And of course, Jacqueline Berrien is a former top official with LDF, Ford Foundation, and the chair of the EEOC, the late Jackie Berrien, who was a tremendous leader in civil rights and a tremendous leader on issues of addressing mass incarceration. And she really made her mark at the EEOC, and we all lost her too soon.
That's true. She lost way too early. An amazing force at the EEOC. And I've known and litigated cases with Jackie long before she went to the EEOC. But LDF also, of course, has a wonderful track record with the law school. You know, Lise Bodie and Rachel Godsill worked with Alexis Cadavan in a stop and frisk case in New York City for quite some time when she was with the NYCLU. And Taja Nia Henderson, which I haven't talked to in a while, but I understand she's on your faculty. And Taja Nia was one of my interns way, 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 way back. So, yes.
Yeah, she told me to tell you, hey, she's now the dean of the graduate school, but she's still on her faculty. And
excellent.
And of course, the clinical director, John Dubin, was at LDF, and David Trout. They have pictures from back in the day. So we have a real strong historical connection with LDF as well. When I was at the OC, Chair Berrien had reached out and said, you know, is there anybody you think that we should invite to talk about issues of mass incarceration? And I thought it was really important that, you know, we have a Latino voice to talk about the issues in our community, which tend to be very complex because we have many communities, right? And I just remember your presentation at that commission meeting, and it was absolutely outstanding and very informative, but it dealt with such a complex topic in our community. And I know that you've been, you know, an expert in that field for a long time. You want to talk a little bit about that work?
Sure. So the specific subject was employment background checks and any particular concerns that arises from a civil rights perspective under, you know, Title VII and other norms that allow us to ensure that we have an equal opportunity to get jobs. And the presentation that I did to the EFC was really based on as much publicly available data about labor segmentation of Latinos in this country and where they work and the likelihood of them being subject to employment background checks. Data that was available at the time to demonstrate how incarceration and convictions are also disproportionately prevalent among Latino populations. And what I really was super fascinated by, and I know the commissioners were, was that we think about these issues as really as a feature of either the Deep South or, you know, from a perspective of Latinos, you know, Texas and or Florida. But some of the biggest disparities between total population of Latinos and Latinos who have criminal records are found in the Northeast. Like Massachusetts had ridiculously large disparities, Pennsylvania, New Jersey at that time, and New York, of course. So we were able to produce some data to the EOC about how employment background checks, if not done correctly, can definitely have an impact on equal opportunity in employment. So it was really an excellent place to start a conversation. And to the EEOC's credit, and David, of course, you directly, because you had a big hand in this, the EEOC guidance on these issues was super important for all employers throughout the country.
Yeah, no, that was, and you know, that is really, you know, the legacy of Jackie Berrien. And you know, I got to litigate cases under the guidance because these are extremely complex cases to litigate, given the statistical evidence. And I think, you know, we finally got it right by the time I left. But I think it's such a profoundly important issue. How did you get involved with that issue? Was that something that created Latino justice or?
Well, I brought additional laws. You know, let me give you some background. When I went to Latino Justice to be the president, I had started there, by the way, many, many years. It was my first job in law school, my first regular attorney job in the 1980s. I come back 25 years later as president, general counsel. And I was like a kid in the candy shop, David. I was like, oh man, I got all these cases I want to file. Where I used to work at Community Service Society, it was an excellent place to work, but it was limited geographically to New York City.
That's where you were before.
That's right.
Where you came to Latino Justice.
Right. I spent almost 20 plus years at Community Service Society, and we were able to bring some fascinating lawsuits on behalf of poor communities in New York City. But when I went back to Latino Justice, Pearl, the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, I had these cases I've been working on, and a lot of them in the area of criminal justice, including one of the cases that became the stop and frisk case that I worked with for Professor Caravan on when she was at the NYCLU. But here's the bottom line, David. The issues of the criminal justice, the criminal legal system's impacts on Latino populations are just, they run deep. It's not just employment, it's immigration, it's family composition, and whether or not, you know, if you're busted for marijuana possession and you're the mother of, you know, two young children, can you lose, you know, custody of your children for that alone? It's everything having to do with racial profiling, which is, you know, writ large, a major problem in Latinx communities throughout the country. So the employment side, the back end of the system, has been a concern of mine for a long time. At Community Service Society, we brought quite a number of cases to try to address the issues of the back end, what happens to you after you get your conviction, either to a plea or to a trial. What I was able to do at Latino Justice was also focus on the front end, you know, policing practices, profiling, excessive policing, broken windows theories, and zero tolerance policing. So that's what gave me a broader reach in terms of the entire system's manifestations on Latino life in the country.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here in Arizona, and of course, Arizona has had more than its fair share of civil rights litigation involving the Latino community because of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and also, you know, some of the very draconian immigration legislation that was passed here a decade back. But I think that, you know, people tend to think of New York City and the Northeast and Boston as being super progressive communities. But I think that, you know, if they think of Arizona at all, they probably think of it as part of the unreconstructed South, which it is sometimes, I think. But in New York City, you saw, you know, the Latino community completely, you know, marginalized vis-a-vis the New York Police Department. By the way, just as a quick plug for people who may not listen to all of the podcast episodes, we did have Alexis Carter on after the uprising last summer, the BLM uprising, talk about this stop and frisk litigation. So she's been a guest here.
There you go.
As well, talking about the litigation. But what gives? Why the difference between reputation and reality on the ground?
Well, a lot of it is because of presence, right? The country has a long, sordid, sad, and outrageously difficult history of dealing with the presence of Latinx people in the country. Our presence was criminalized so long ago, you know, 1920s, after the National Origin Quotas Act of 1924, the country then embarked on creating criminal penalties for crossing the border, affecting Mexicanos throughout the entire Southwest in untold ways, and increasing the incarceration of Mexicanos and other Latinos exponentially ever since. So I think there's a lot of that. The other thing is, David, is that the stop and frisk and policing practices gave us a window into was that the issues are not just directed to us because of our status. It's not just because we look like we're immigrants or we look like we're undocumented. With stop and frisk activity was directed at long-standing Latino populations of New York City, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, you know, people who've been there for generations. And a lot of that had to do with just the theory of policing as we know in the modern era, which was if you allow for zero tolerance policing and focus on minor infractions, the theory goes, you will eventually capture the big fish. You will find that person with an unlicensed firearm in their pocket, or you will find that person who's wanted for a major felony warrant. The problem, of course, is that the theory then presumes that you can constitutionally stop excessively a lot of people to find that one or two persons with contraband or firearms. And that creates havoc on people of color communities. And that's what we were able to stop in New York City.
And talk about the psychological impact both on the individuals, but also the community in terms of being almost like a constant target of the police.
Yeah. So anytime in any kind of system in which you increase the number of engagement points with a particular community and it's being done by police, then you're taking risks. The risk is that one of those engagements can go wrong, that, you know, you wake up one morning, you're tired of the fact that you've been stopped by police three times that month and you mouth off. And next thing you know, there's violence involved. So anytime you deal with these issues and you increase these engagements, and this also, and David, this goes to the heart of understanding the reactions to this. It goes to the heart of recognizing that if you're a young teenager of 17 years old and your first interaction with police is over some BS crap that you know you're not committing a crime, and in fact, you weren't even given a ticket, you're not arrested, so you know you're just being harassed because of what you look like, that just feeds into the distrust that many people of color communities have in the country, and especially in urban America, of over-policing tactics. It just exists as an occupying force to harass people repeatedly. We also found, David, that there was always an uptick in the number of stops and frisks forms that were filled out and arrests for trespass, because that was the case we did, right after the police academy let out its new cadets. So these new cadets were actually being told, go out there, learn how to do an arrest for trespass. But if your first one, go ahead and do it when you know it was all BS and not justified by the law or probable cause at all.
And you know, so much of this started under Mayor Giuliani, this sort of broken windows theory of policing. But I think concurrently, you know, there was an effort, and you see this in the cities across the country, there was an effort at really kind of reshaping and remodeling the look of the city in terms of making them much more attractive as tourist meccas. So, you know, obviously during the same period of time when you had the beginning of, you know, broken windows policing, you had the world's biggest Disney store in Times Square.
Sorry.
And you had, you know, just really just a massively increase in the cost of housing in Manhattan, in particular Manhattan and Brooklyn in particular. Do you see the relationship between the two? Is that something that is necessarily related, or, you know, can you have one without the other?
Not sure you can have one without the other. You can definitely have one that could be tied to job explosion or, you know, labor force expansion, let's say in the Silicon Valley, or labor force expansion in places like Seattle, in which you would have the same forces that create gentrification, with not necessarily with the concomitant broken windows policing, although I'm sure we've seen those in those localities too. But what happens with broken windows policing, I mean, remember, this was started by Giuliani, but exploded on the Bloomberg.
Right.
And then Police Chief Bratton took these theories and brought them to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So this is the game in policing, modern policing techniques is based on these issues. Plus, you know, comp stat, in other words, computerized data points and geographic geocoding of where activity occurs. So this is all hand in hand with these issues. I think what we learned and what I learned at Latino Justice, what I relearned at Latino Justice, because, you know, we grew up in the same streets that we're talking about, is that these issues affect Latinx populations too, in disproportionate ways and in very, very harmful ways. So what we're seeing is, you know, the kind of profiling that occurs in New York because of broken windows occurs in Long Island because you're driving down a particular road and you're driving while brown. And it occurs in all over the southern border, 100-mile buffer zone. It occurred like crazy with Joe Arpaio, of course, where you're sitting right now, in Maricopa County. So it occurs everywhere. So the relationship between, you know, creating the safest big city in America, which Bloomberg touted, is super tied to what you mentioned before about tourism and gentrification. But at the end of the day, the profiling that exists in that level of New York City is the profiling that exists along the border towns of Texas and Arizona and New Mexico every day of the week.
And as somebody new to the region, one of the variables that seem almost uniquely tied to New York City is the police union in New York City. And I think, you know, that's, I guess, you know, kind of surprised me a little bit, but, you know, I know that the police union has a lot of political weight in New York City. Do you want to talk about the role of the police union and to maybe work with the police, whether there's a possibility to work with the police union on some of these issues or whether those have hit dead ends?
Well, I think right now, police unions across the country are recognizing that they've probably gone as far as they could, and they're going to be dealing with issues of accountability, a lot of it because of the movement in defense of Black lives. We're finally having serious conversations about accountability on multiple fronts. But David, the police unions in New York City were obstacles towards any kind of sensible policing practices goes back to the 1970s and 60s. You know, the use of excessive use of force and sometimes deadly force against unarmed Puerto Rican, Latino, and Black individuals in New York City is rampant throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, and thereafter. So I'll give you an example. The 48-hour rule. So there was a 48-hour rule built into the contract between the police unions and New York City and other localities, in which if a police officer shoots his firearm and it causes a harm or even death, then the investigators, either from the police or from any other entity, cannot interview the police officer involved for 48 hours until he or she can consult with their union reps about their rights, read about what they're going to say. So the 48-hour rule was created by, you know, just simple, the force of, you know, labor negotiations. And you get what you can when you're negotiating on behalf of the union, and they got a lot of concessions. I hear that the labor union contracts in San Antonio, Texas, were like the model of the entire country. People wanted to be officers, wanted to work there because they had incredible perks. So right now, these unions, as super forceful as they are and have been and continue to be, they're now running into the accountability pressure of the public, in which we're finally recognizing that accountability starts from all these issues, including what positions we can force our governments to take during labor negotiations to take back some semblance of accountability. Otherwise, these individuals are both, they work in a very insular, we all know this, they work in a very insular field. It's a very dangerous job, but they've created a culture that protects their own above everything else. And that's something that, of course, then runs smack into the protection of constitutional rights.
I want you to just talk briefly about a recent victory that you had. It's not quite a victory yet, but it's for all of us class action lawyers, it's an interim victory. But then I want to kind of turn our attention to this past summer and the BLM uprisings that we saw in Newark and New York City and all over the country and all over the world. And I want to talk about that in relationship to alliances between the African-American and the Latinx community. But just talk really quickly about the case that you were telling me about earlier, if you want.
Sure. So we have this wonderful case. You got to love the title, the caption of the case, David. It's Plaintiffs 1 through 21, Suffolk County. And why are they called Plaintiffs 1 through 21? Because they all have, you know, anonymity orders. They're all undocumented Latinos, all from Central America, many from El Salvador. And they were being harassed and profiled when they drove their vehicles along a stretch of road in Suffolk County. And they were being harassed by one particular police sergeant and many others. Some of them were robbed, literally robbed of their money. We brought the lawsuit, ensuring that we would get some reforms and justice for these individuals. And to their credit, they stepped up and became our clients. Not an easy thing to do. And by the way, David, we've been able to secure significant interim relief for them. All of them got U visas because pro bono law firm stepped up to the plate with Latino Justice, asking them to represent these individuals and get certified and get U visa certification. All to say that we just got a word that we got class action certification. The lawsuit addresses not just actions of one or two individual officers, but also just profiling writ large, traffic violation stops, which were unnecessary. And hopefully the next time we speak, we'll give you a positive result of that lawsuit as well.
For the people who aren't familiar with U visas, can you just give them a couple of paragraphs on that?
Yeah, so a U visa permits deferred deportation practices for individuals who have been certified oftentimes by law enforcement, either prosecutor's office or law enforcement directly, as being a critical witness in an ongoing criminal investigation or in an investigation that has been just completed. And a U visa not only defers prosecution, but it also permits temporary work authorization. And that is, as you all know, for undocumented populations, that's a golden nugget, so to speak. So it often uses well for victims of domestic violence. It's not easy. The number of U visas and the waiting list for U visas can be years long. Unfortunately, Congress and the executive branch have not increased the allotment, and hopefully that might change now. But they're critically important for ensuring that undocumented populations are able to also not get be protected when they need law enforcement, but are able to be cooperative with law enforcement where necessary. So there's something for them to get if everything pans out.
Yeah. Yeah, we use them pretty frequently in sexual harassment cases at the EOC. So this past summer, you know, we saw, I think according to the New York Times, you know, about 1.5 million people take to the streets in really the biggest mass protest movement in this country's history, you know, following the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, it came in the context of a pandemic that where I think, you know, we saw a lot of the systemic health disparities play out against Black and Brown communities. And it was just a tremendously powerful moment. And, you know, I recently wrote a foreword for the Rutgers Law Review about the great pandemic and great reckoning, but I acknowledged in the article that, you know, the reckoning has not yet proven to be great. That's more of a hopeful aspiration in terms of whether there's a reckoning, whether, you know, the force that was unleashed is something that could be transformative, you know, to our country as we finally deal with, you know, many of the issues that have been here since the founding. So talk to me about your thoughts about what we saw this summer and where we are, not quite, but almost 1 year later.
Well, what I saw and what I felt is the culmination of so many struggles before, right? It's the culmination of incredible activism around police accountability when it comes to use of force. I mean, and those episodes of insistence on accountability occur in each one of our communities. There is unfortunately a lack of mainstream attention paid to how this plays out for Latinx communities in the country. So a lot of names of people who otherwise should be at the tip of our tongue have not received that kind of attention across the board. But there should never be the conclusion that Latinx populations are not resisting and not demanding accountability. We've seen significant protests in California, in Bakersfield, where Latino Justice was at several times, California and Kern County. And of course, in Los Angeles, over the killing of Andres Guardado, and of course, many other parts of the country, and in different manifestations of how we see these issues of police use of force resulting in death against unarmed individuals, has to be forced in terms of accountability measures. Not easy things to do. The law protects police officers' use of discretion in so many ways. Qualified immunity then protects them against any kind of particular judgment or judgment against the municipalities involved. So we have quite a bit to go. But David, what I felt was not only the culmination of so many decades of activism, but an incredible juxtaposition of the question of accountability and divestment from police forces. Defunding of police force, of police units, creating the opportunity to discuss openly why do we continue to invest resources in a way that doesn't require, that doesn't demand accountability from for abuse. What is it about the needs of our community that can be better served by more saner approaches to government use of its incredible funds? And that for me was pushed to front and center by this incredible array of activism and organizers, starting with, of course, everyone involved with the movement to defend Black Lives, but really spreading across all of our racial and marginalized groups in the country, because I've seen this play out in so many ways. And we saw it as well in the Stop and Frisk activity in New York City. But when it comes to issues of police use of force, it has a way to galvanize a lot of mobilization from LGBTQ and trans communities to Asian American communities to Latino communities to African American and Black communities and youth communities. So many ways, and those of us who are involved in this work can see this as a unifying way to make sure we have accountability. So for me, it was a really excellent way to recognize the work of the past, but then crystallize it with specific demands that are really attuned to what we need to do today.
And you know, a couple of things that I thought were just so inspirational. And I went out with the students in Newark the first day of the marches, and many of our students were very involved in the organizing efforts and in the marches. But one of the things that I found, you know, I think in many ways unique is sort of the organization kind of harkens back to Ella Baker and Freedom Summer. Mm-hmm. It was really, you know, very non-hierarchical. There was an incredibly effective use of social media. And you saw this sort of hierarchical structure that strong people don't need strong leaders, and the way that it was organized. And it's something that, you know, kind of harkens back to what you saw in Chile, what you saw in Hong Kong, what you saw in Paris. That it's just a new way to organize, where you kind of empower the individuals. So that was one thing that was very different that I saw. And then the other thing was, you know, I think, you know, perhaps under the influence of Ibram X. Kendi, but the whole notion that you can sort of sit silently by and sit neutral was something that was really called into question by so many of the people who were out there. that you're either being a non-racist is not a thing, that you're either an anti-racist or you're not, right? Right. And that the whole idea of emboldening, you know, I think allies to the movement was something that, frankly, on such a mass scale, I saw as incredibly new. That, you know, the whole notion of what it means to be an ally in this movement was something that was really examined very closely. And I think there's a lot of thought given to it. And I was very proud of our Latinx community at Rutgers, because there's a lot of thought given to what it means to be an ally in the BLM movement. And that meant a lot of introspection about racism within our own community, right? And colorism within our own community.
You're right. I mean, look, let's start with us, right? You know, we forget that, we tend to forget that the enslaved Africans brought to this new world were more brought to places outside of the U.S. than ever before. Like 95% were brought to places outside of the U.S. So we're going to deal with issues of race and colorism in our Latin American, South American, Central American, Caribbean native countries in many, many ways, with the same devastating effects if you're Black or if you're dark-skinned. I always look at the way to understand better what Latinx populations, how they address race in the United States, you have to understand how race was addressed in the native countries. And to get to that point, then you recognize this entire panoply of racial attitudes, colorism, and everything that goes with it, right? You know, so I grew up, you know, I grew up in this country, but my parents and all of my connections and family are in Puerto Rico in the Caribbean. And the commentary that you will hear is not that different from other Caribbean countries, right? So there's, you know, the best example is the most frequent one that I've always heard was pelo bueno or pelo malo, right? You had good hair, you had bad hair. But there's a bunch of stuff that happens in our communities that we have to address. And the second thing, David, though, is that, and we just started to do this as well in the last year or so at Latino Justice, is we're anchoring our conversations of race with the Latino community also in our indigenous racial roots. Right. Because we have to recognize that people who look indigenous in our home countries are treated at the very bottom of the social strata. The word indio is pejorative in many of our home countries, and it's done on purpose. And then the fact that many of these groups and many of these nations, they are nations, Native American nations, have their own languages, which are rich and they flourish. So we've been dealing with Latino justice. It's just the tip of the iceberg of understanding racism within our community, not just against Afro-Latinos, but also against indigenous Latinos, because A, because of their features, B, because of the language, and C, because of their marginalization. So we got a lot to do.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about defund, because, you know, obviously during the recent election that became, you know, kind of a hot button issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a wonderful panel on policing with Roy Austin, who was an upper level official in the Civil Rights Division under Obama. And he's like, look, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I think words matter. And he goes, I probably would have phrased it different. He goes, I don't have an objection to the policy, but it's just sort of the phrasing that I think, you know, became, I think, somewhat controversial when it was thrown into the political realm. It became a little bit of red meat. Do you have any thoughts on that? I think politically, a congressman from a very well-known Latina congressman from the Bronx said, defund only means what you do in every single suburb in the United States, which means that you allocate resources to social services and you don't have the big tanks rolling through the streets. And, you know, that's a very common sense way to understand it. But talk a little bit about the language and whether you think it helps the cause or how it plays out.
You know, David, you know, those of us who speak one more than one language, we're considered bilingual. So we've been code switching since the moment we were born, basically. That's what I've been code switching over between two languages for a while. So I also know how to code switch when I talk to certain audiences, be they racially defined or professionally defined or government defined. So, yeah, there are nuances in language we can always talk about at the end of the day. But what's important about defund as a term and as a concept is it goes to the heart of what these questions are raising. Right? Now, if you look at the language used, you know, in the publicly available language being used in messaging by BLM, you see, you know, divest and invest. Another excellent way to talk about this, I should say. We're going to divest from the features of government that harm and invest into the features of government that can actually produce positive change, healing, restoration, and an ability to thrive. Because at the end of the day, the dollars that we've been that are being used for harm have to be used not just, again, not just to keep us to a point in which we're just surviving this mess, but we should be have the opportunity to thrive. Just like the investments of previous generations in this country were able to create the GI Bill, we were able to create all this incredible dollars for mortgages and financing for homes at the height of our industrial, you know, our incredible post-World War II expansion of the economy. And a lot of those features of investment were foreclosed for people of color, especially African Americans. And when you look at it that way, those were investments based on what we thought would be perfectly done to increase the opportunities and help those communities thrive. So yeah, I hear us on defund is a pain in the ass because it really is, it throws red meat. But at the end of the day, I can call it anything I want if I'm recognizing that the goal is to stop investing in the features of government that create harm with no accountability and start investing in the features of government that actually produce thriving, productive, sustainable communities.
Very, very, very beautifully said. Let me ask you this. When Professor Cardone was here, she, of course, is an incredibly creative lawyer, and she worked on the stop and frisk. But I interviewed her right during, I think, you know, when, you know, people were in the streets across the country. And she, I think, waxed a little skeptically about the ultimate limitations of litigation to address some of the policing problems, as opposed to what was then going on politically. Do you have thoughts on that? And, you know, I'm a civil rights litigator too. And so I know that, you know, for the individual that you are, when you're able to vindicate someone's rights under federal law, you know, that individual, you transform their lives. And then you've seen sort of much more broadly the LDFs, you know, not just NAACP, but Latino Justice and MALDEF and ACLU work on incredible impact litigation. But do you ever think, well, this is just part of it. We still need to have the people out there engaged politically and in the streets as part of the solution?
Yeah, no question, David. Look, if we were all personal injury attorneys, we'd be happy. We'll sleep very well every night, right? Our clients get the $1 million settlement and they get paid in dollars. End of story.
Yeah.
But when you're suing to change government practices or you're suing to change institutional practices, when you're suing to create reform, then litigation is very, 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 very difficult tool to accomplish all those aims. The issue of changing police culture because that's at the end of the day, that's what we're changing. Stop and frisk was police culture at the highest levels of the hierarchy, right? They're the ones telling line police officers, fill out the forms. They were quotas, you know, fill out this, stop people, give me some forms, give me some numbers, give me some arrests. The line officers weren't making those decisions, but the culture was such that it was created from the top down. At the end of the day, changing that culture through litigation is very difficult. And we're going to change a lot of this. Stop and frisk has been curbed, has been eliminated, but it has been curbed significantly. But I could have said the same thing about marijuana. That's right. We've seen those drop down, but they're still disproportionately Black and brown in New York City and elsewhere, and including New Jersey, before the legalizations came into effect just a couple of weeks ago. I've done systemic education rights cases, like bilingual education cases, when I started in my career at Puerto Rican Legal, and those were also limited. We won the lawsuit, we won the consent decree, but they were limited because we didn't, as lawyers, as public interest lawyers, didn't pay enough attention to the infrastructure that's going to create the political pressure to obtain and consistently get the victories implemented. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of lawyers in an office somewhere looking at reports about compliance. And it doesn't have the real nuts and bolts on the ground monitoring that's necessary to consistently change a system as big as the New York City public education system, which we did to the bilingual education cases, NASPIDA versus Board of Ed. I see the same parallels in our stop and frisk litigation and in any litigation that I've been involved with that has dealt with significant reform. Lawyers have to recognize that at the end of the day, we're just one of multiple people who bring tools to the table. If the tools are in litigation, they're significantly important. They can add to the broader mobilization efforts that are being done by organizing people who are on the ground. If we win, it doesn't mean we've won. It just means we've gotten a court to agree with us or a defendant to agree with us in the settlement. But at the end of the day, is that mobilization has to continue. The organizers have to be supported. The people that we know are at the front end of the battle have to be nurtured, have to be supported, and have to be heard so that lawyers can then recognize that some things have to be tweaked, some things have to be changed, sometimes things have to be thrown out the window to start all over again. I love litigating these cases, but I also recognize that at the end of the day, it's just one tool.
But before I turn your attention to our beloved Rutgers Law School, talk a little bit more about some of the other stuff going on at Latino Justice. I know we talked about the policing work, but I know that Latino Justice does so much more than policing.
No, we're super busy, of course, with the aftermath of the elections and election protection work in 2020. We were in Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania. I personally spent all day 2020 election doing protection work in Pennsylvania, in two different counties in Pennsylvania. I traveled all day. Our staff was all over. And then we went back to Georgia for the runoff, the senatorial runoff in January. Again, providing assistance to making sure, especially around language issues. Very, very fortunate that we were able to change how elections are run from a language perspective. Even as recently as January in Georgia, in Liberty County, we changed overnight because they were refusing to translate things in that county. So our work is ongoing. So right now we're getting ready for redistricting, which is now going to be overwhelming work between now and the next couple of years. Census data is being delayed, but the opportunities to create more districts that truly reflect the voting strength of Latinx, African American, Asian American communities is going to be played out all over the country on multiple levels, starting with Congress all the way down. So that's what we're doing next, and it's really exciting work.
Yeah, that's wonderful. How optimistic are you about the prospects of pushing back on some of these voter restrictions that are coming up across the country, including in Maricopa County, where I sit?
Uphill battle. Really uphill battle. We've seen the Supreme Court already indicate certain things that are just pretty outrageous. However, I will tell you this. I thought that the oral argument in the last case, on the issue of disqualifying votes that were cast in the wrong precinct, even though they were by valid eligible voters, and why that was so. The commentary by the attorney in argument for Supremes that said, well, that just, if the question was, you know, why are you doing this? What exactly is being served by you taking the position that valid votes issued by eligible voters would actually hurt? And he said, well, it puts the party at a disadvantage. When one of our national political parties' winning strategies is to reduce the number of eligible voters who vote, and they're so bold enough to say it openly in front of the Supreme Court, I'm just hoping a handful of justices who otherwise would have been inclined to say, that's just politics, let them do it, will wake up and say, this is a real threat to democracy. Eligible voters are being reduced. That's crazy.
I was really excited when we had our conversation about bringing you over. And I realized that I've used this Peter Rodino distinguishing visiting professorship to bring over people to shake things up on a faculty that already likes to shake things up. Just super elated to be able to bring you over and have you teach. We were trying to figure out what you would do. And it just seemed natural that you would teach Latinos in the law just because, you know, it's a space that we hadn't occupied specifically here at the law school. Talk a little bit about, you know, your experience, your class, and, you know, why you think it's an important class to teach.
Oh, definitely. First of all, thank you, David, for making the opportunity available to me. Really look forward to it. I'm glad it finally worked out. David, I mean, the basic line
My theme throughout the entire course is, and it's a writing course, so I'm looking forward to the excellent research that I expect from the students and their views about various topics, and there's so many topics that we can talk about. But the theme of the course is to address some of these issues that revolve around what I call invisibility. Like, there's a lot of lack of understanding of our role in the area of both civil rights and constitutional law enforcement. The course says not only have those mega lawsuits, San Antonio versus Rodriguez about public education financing, Hernandez versus Texas about, you know, does an equal protection clause go beyond a two-class theory of white and black, and they also affect Latinos, especially Mexicans at that time in the 50s. And Mendez versus Westminster talks about segregation of Latinos from whites, the juror segregation in public schools, multiple cases. Hernandez versus New York, which talks about bilingualism and whether or not that can be a feature to knock you off of a jury by a peremptory challenge because you happen to understand two languages and the testimony is likely to be in Spanish. All those issues are super important. And I've seen that a lot of the common thread is the law affects the life of Latinx populations in the country, but we don't often talk about how Latinxes have used the courts to also shape their lives and how this incredible activism of lawyering that goes back to the 50s, especially out of Texas, and the makings of, you know, Michael Olivas, right? The makings of Mexican-American lawyering in Hernandez versus Texas. I love that research and how he has been able to paint these issues about representing Mexicanos in a way to ensure that they get equal treatment. But Latinx populations have used courts and the law to try to shape how they're being treated by the government. And that's what this course also talks about. And we talk about in multiple areas from the schoolhouse to curriculum. One more time. David, you're in a hot spot in Arizona one more time trying to get rid of Mexican-American curriculum at one particular time. So
English only. Every
English single only. Everything, every issue comes out of it.
You could do a whole class. You could do a whole class out of Arizona.
Arizona only. But the bottom line is this. This is really exciting discussions. And students are super engaged. And it's a wonderful class. So I really look forward to the culmination of the whole year. And the writings and the viewpoints that I'm sure going to learn from.
Yeah, and you know, I'm teaching a civil rights, civil liberties class to the undergrads, and I've you know very intentionally pulled in Hernandez and Westminster versus Mendez, as well as a lot of cases involving the Asian American community.
Yes.
And sort of the hidden history of the civil rights litigation at the end of the 19th century, the Chinese Exclusion Act, Miyako B. Hopkins. And just, you know, really, you know, trying to draw parallels and interconnections, not as a way to say, you know, these are different communities, but as a way to say that all of these movements play off of each other and benefit from each other. And yeah. So Westminster versus Mendez was really a dry run in many respects for Thurgood Marshall on the use of social science evidence in the courtroom. And they were very conscious in the case involving the segregation of Latino students of the long-term strategic considerations. And I just think that those are just important stories to tell.
Definitely.
I did a panel for the ABA yesterday on race and diversity. And I was asked at the end, you know, about final thoughts or final resources. And, you know, I understand that, you know, I'm the dean at a law school and the students are, you know, my central stakeholder group, the primary focus. But I am really super impressed with these kids, just in terms of their tenacity and their thoughtfulness. And I think their ability to kind of work cross-culturally and support each other. I've been very impressed. So I don't know what you're, you know, I work with the students on a daily basis. I know that you come in and teach. What are your impressions?
Well, I cannot agree with you more. We're talking about individuals who actually do get what Audre Lorde said. I don't live a single issue life. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Because I don't live in a single issue. We're all intersection of multiple issues. And I think that is paramount in understanding both the passion and the organizing skills and the perspective that this younger generation has been able to bring to the issues of race, to the issues of accountability, to the issues of the environment, to the issues of workforce, the issues of, you know, this this monster of student debt, healthcare, every issue that we think is important in terms of making the country stronger and to recognize the contributions that we all make to the country, it stems from that recognition that we're not single issue people because we don't live single issue lives.
Yep. One final thing, you know, I think when we brought you over, I'm like, oh, Juan, can you do this? You know, can you do that? We just wanted to make full use of you, even though you had a, you know, more than a full-time job at Latino Justice. And so one of the things that we're planning is a major, I would call it a major national Latino Civil Rights Summit. Do you want to talk a little bit about what we have planned?
Yes, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm hoping that the students and the faculty and the broader community will listen in too. So on April 23rd, I think at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so that's a Friday, April 23rd at 3 p.m., we'll start a conversation among myself and two other amazing civil rights leaders in this country. Janet Mulguia is the head of Unidos U.S., formerly known as the National Council of La Raza, a membership organization with significant years and decades of work in the Latino community to address issues of marginalization of our gente. And she'll be sharing some thoughts, especially about the immigrants' rights battles that we currently have in the country. It's going to anchor a lot of her comments, but a lot of these conversations will be, you know, free-flowing between the three of us. The second one is Tom Sainz, who is my counterpart, amazing Tom, President and General Counsel of Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Tom is physically based out of LA, Janet physically based out of DC. Tom has been the head of it for probably 11 to 12 years by now, of MALDEF, and has done amazing work with MALDEF throughout the country. And he will focus on some of the issues that are pressing right now from a civil rights perspective in the area of political participation and democracy building, from everything from the census to redistricting that you're in, everything in between. And then I will focus on issues of the criminal justice transformation. So a lot of some of the issues that you and I discussed right here, David, and go beyond that to talk about the connections to these two other features, right, of immigration and also voting rights and political participation. And we're all going to sit in conversation with you, David Lopez. Yes.
Yeah, I've done panels with, you know, Tom Sainz before. I mean, I don't think I've met a more, I'd be hard pressed to find a more brilliant attorney that I've met in my whole career. Like the man is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, Tom sees big picture above the big picture.
Yeah,
he's in many, many ways.
Yeah.
And what I love about Janet is that Janet has been super instrumental in making sure that a lot of these voices also get heard in Washington Beltway politics.
Yeah,
and her knowledge of who does what and what needs to get done is super important. And she's a leader in so many levels. It's wonderful to also get her perspective as well on these issues.
Yeah, Janet is outstanding, and that organization. My wife worked at that organization, 20 years ago, and you know, talk about having a national grassroots impact. It's a tremendous organization. Her leadership has been tremendous. We'll have a good discussion. Well, anyway, so any final thoughts, any advice to people out there about where we stand at the present moment?
Needless to say, we live in very, very exciting times. We have within our lifetimes the ability to change a lot of beautiful things for the better. We have a lot of risks, a lot of peril, a lot of uncertainty. But the more and more I listen to individuals who are trying to do good and bend that arc of justice towards positive change, the more I'm convinced that I'm privileged to pick the profession that allows me to play a hand in this. Privileged to have a chance to talk to students of Rutgers Law, and just looking forward for the next chapter in all of our lives.
Thank you so much, Juan Cartagena. Just two guys from the neighborhood having a
chance. There you go.
Thank you so much.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal, small campus experience. Learn more about Rutgers Law by visiting law.rutgers.edu.